You're listening to Trucking Questions from the Audio Road with Kevin Rutherford. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. You can ask questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, tax, technology, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the Audio Road.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, buying and selling trucks and trailers, you name it, we'll talk about it here on the air. All you have to do is pick up the phone and join us. I'll do my best to get you an answer to whatever question you bring. And if I can't answer it, many times we get some help from the other listeners as well. I don't have a lot I want to talk about today. I am back on the road, which is fun for me. It's also a lot of work. And it takes me just a little while to get into that routine and to create some new habits while I'm on the road. And that's kind of what I'm working on right now. So I'm typically driving about 6 hours a day, working about 6 to 8 hours a day between doing the shows a couple hours a day and, you know, just keeping up with running the company and those things. And then I still have to take care of the truck and trailer on the road. And you know what it's like taking care of a truck. The RV trailer is just, it can be a lot of work. I love having it, but it seems like I'm always working on something. There's multiple electrical systems, a 12-volt system, a 110 system AC. There's a couple air conditioners. There's a lot of plumbing. There's the hydraulic lift system, the slides, a satellite, internet, just on and on and on. It seems like there's always something. So right now, it feels like I'm really busy, and a couple things had to get put aside. I haven't done any TV at all, nothing online. And the other thing that's suffering a little bit right now is my reading, but I'm able to make up for that while I'm driving. I'm listening to some audiobooks instead. So all in all, it's been a good first week on the road, but with that being said, I don't have a whole lot of material today, so be good for you. I'm going to get right to some phone calls. Let's start off in Alabama. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What can I help you with today?
Tax question regarding a W-2, I guess, is with your social, and then a 1099. They had me set up a federal tax ID. It's not under my social. So when I go to file my 1040, how would I have to do two separate 1040s, one for the ID and one for the social?
No, the federal ID is kind of matched to your social security number, and it's its own entity, but the only time you file any other tax return, the 1040 itself is a tax return, and there are a lot of what we call schedules or forms you can put inside that return. The only other time we file a different type of return is if we form another business entity, a partnership, an LLC, an S corp, a C corp. Then they have their own tax return. They generate some forms, and then the individual puts those forms in their tax return, whoever owns it or is shareholders. But as an individual, you will file a 1040 just like you always have. Your W-2s will show up as wages, as an employee wages. And then because you have a 1099, you will have to fill out a couple additional forms. And the two forms are the Schedule C. And the Schedule C is called Business Income and Loss. That's where you would show the 1099 revenue as income on the tax return. And then on that same form, you'll also show any expenses you had against that revenue. So while you were being paid on a 1099, your per diem, for example, goes on the Schedule C. But while you were being paid on a W-2, per diem needs to be separated for those two times. And part of it on the Schedule C, the other part as an employee goes on the Schedule A and Form 2106. That's where you'll show the per diem while you were a driver. And the same goes for any expenses, you know, supplies, anything that's deductible. While you were being paid on a W-2, those go on the Schedule A, and there might be some sub-forms like the 2106. Then on the Schedule C, you'll report all the expenses while you were being paid on a 1099.
Okay, that clarifies everything. Thank you.
You're welcome. So, and I hope it clarifies. It sounds, I'm glad you got it. It sounds confusing to me when I say it, but that's just because our tax system is pretty complicated. Let's go to Alabama. Stu, welcome to the program.
Better tax yesterday, Kevin.
Absolutely. Every time I have to talk about taxes, and then, you know, I get done with all those forms and explanations, and I think, you know, there's 10 other things I could try to explain to somebody, but nobody's going to remember any of it anyway. So hopefully, if somebody's doing their own tax return, they're reading and researching, and if they're paying somebody else to do it, they've got somebody good.
I was going to get on here and ask you to repeat what you said just a little while ago, just a little bit slower so I could write it down, but I figure I'll catch it on the replay. Kevin, what I'm calling today about is I am a company driver, longtime listener, you know. They got me in one of these trucks. It's got one of them trick automatic transmissions in it. It's that DT12.
Okay.
By Detroit. Now, I like I said, I am a company driver, but I still think I proved my worth by getting the best fuel economy I know how for the company. And this thing's got that weird transmission, and the shift point is that where I would usually drive in the manual truck that I was driving. So you go up a hill, and it wants to downshift. And it revs the nuts off of it. And, you know, and then it wants to upshift once you crest the hill. And, anyway, I was just kind of wondering, 390s, DT12 automatic and a DDEC, I believe it's 15. Is there a way to figure out the best RPM to run for, fuel economy on something that new, or
yeah, there is
science now.
I don't know it, but I can tell you how to figure it out if we have a couple gauges. But the one thing that caught my attention there, are you sure they're 390s?
Yes, sir. It's in a Penske lease, long-term lease truck.
Well, let me first start off by saying this. I have a tremendous amount of experience with rental trucks from, and that's really what this is. I know it's long term, but it's still a rental truck. Penske spec'd it and set it up. And I've rented from everybody out there for years because of my operation at FedEx. We ran, you know, 5 and 6 days a week. The only day we had time to get trucks worked on was on a Monday. Every shop around the terminal was always swamped on Mondays because we had so many contractors in that same position. So many times for me, it made more sense instead of trying to squeeze in on a Monday and know everybody's going to rush the job. I would usually just rent a truck for a couple days, get stuff worked on, then get the truck back on the road. And I swear, not only did my drivers hate those trucks, they got the worst fuel economy ever. I don't know what Penske does or any of the rental companies. I would look at them and go, well, you know, the specs aren't that great, but even that doesn't seem like it should have killed the fuel mileage the way that it did. My fleet average was anywhere from 7.5 to 8. And every time we would get a rental truck, we'd be down in the mid fives. And it would just drive me crazy. But so don't expect that you're going to get a lot. I cannot believe that they spec'd a DD15 with 390s. You'd be better off with 290s.
Yeah. Well, I'll give Kim my fuel gauges numbers. And okay. you'll see that this thing is just getting tremendous fuel economy.
Really?
But it's been in the shop several times, but it is getting tremendous fuel economy, no doubt.
So for
how they spec'd it.
Maybe they got, they've always spec'd 390s. That's like their standard gear. Because a lot of times their rentals are just running around the city and, you know, fairly close. 390s, from everything I've heard about that engine and that transmission, sounds like the worst possible gear you could put in there. And yet, maybe there's something we don't know. Maybe we're going to learn something. When you just give me a rough idea. Are we talking about eights or nines?
Well, we're talking mid-eights on a flat run. Flat run.
Got it. All right, hold that thought. I'm going to get to a break, and we'll come right back. And I'll tell you how we can kind of maximize this and see where it really wants to run. My first thought is it would want to run slow, like 53 miles an hour with those gears. But I could be wrong. We don't have a lot of experience with these yet. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. I'm going to head right back to Alabama. I was talking with Stu. All right. So does this truck have a boost gauge or a pyrometer?
I do see. No, actually, it does not. It's got the, you know, it's got the standard oil gauge that I guess you could try to do something with.
No, we really can't. It's going to make it tough. Either those two gauges or a scan gauge. It should have an instant read fuel economy gauge. Does it have that?
Yes, sir. It sure does.
That's what you're going to have to play around with then. Now, we know that they're not accurate. We don't use them to really know what our fuel economy is, but we can certainly use them to help us drive. Now, my experience is that one's going to change so quick that it's going to be tough to keep up with. But it's still, if you play around with it, you should be able to get some ideas. And what you'll want to do is find stretches of road that are as level as possible for as long as possible. Reset the gauge. If it has that function, reset it back to zero. Watch your fuel economy over a long, flat, straight for as long as you can. Record that number. Then and what you're going to do is just kind of keep track of, okay, when I was on the level this time, I was in 12th gear. This is a 12 speed, right?
Yes, sir.
I was in 12th gear, and my RPM was right here, my speed was here, and my fuel economy was 8.6. And the next time you get a nice, strong, long level road, try it in... Well, I don't think you could ever use 11 with 390s. All you're really going to be able to play around with is speed. I mean,
yes,
we can't.
Sir,
the rear ends are just too low to do that. So my guess is the slower you go, the better the fuel economy is going to get. We don't have any other options.
It really is a trick. I've tried it everywhere between 55 and about 61 miles an hour. When you go below 53, it just wants to keep shifting back into 11th and back into 12th. And that just to me seems like it's going to hurt the transmission somehow, and I'm scared to do it.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it. We don't need to go that slow, and that it won't hurt the transmission. It's just annoying. So I would say that if your goal, and it sounds like it is to get the best fuel economy possible and you're willing to drive that slow, I would say set your cruise at 55 and forget it.
All right. Do you have one more question about the new TND tablet?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, the man that lives inside of it that tells me when to turn, when you get close to your destination. I can hear that click seven counties over whenever you click the screen, but the little guy that lives in there, I can barely hear him. I've played around with the volumes and the settings and all that. Maybe I'm doing something wrong. Can you throw me a suggestion here?
Yeah, all of those sounds are adjustable. The clicking sounds you can get rid of if you want to, and it's in settings. And the volumes, when you hit the volume button on top, then you should see the slider. And right next to the slider, you should see a little symbol for like a graphic equalizer kind of thing.
Oh, there it is. All right. And there's a middle thing right there, right?
Yep.
Oh, thank you so much, Kevin.
You're welcome.
All right. Sorry to bother you for that, but I appreciate it.
No problem. It took me a while to figure that out, too. But what it does is each slider allows you to adjust different volumes. Like for me, I'll keep my audiobooks turned up. Then I'll keep the navigation turned down just under that, so the navigation really isn't interfering a lot with the audiobook. Then there's another slider for sounds. So it's very customizable, and you just play around with it, and I think you'll get it the way you want it. Let's go to Oregon. Rebecca and Seth, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin.
Kevin, how's it going?
Hey,
well,
there.
We've been waiting a long time to make this call.
Well, it sounds exciting. What's up today?
Well, if I look out my front window, I can see a beautiful 2003 Columbia truck. And that's my truck.
That is such a great feeling, isn't it? You guys worked hard on that, too. Congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. I mean, hard doesn't even begin to describe it.
I know. You know, here's the thing. You guys, it's always exciting buying a truck, starting a business, all of those things. But it's so much more exciting when you know you've done it the right way. You know, you don't have those nagging little doubts in the back of your head. You know you've been doing this right. And I'm not saying you didn't make any mistakes, and you're going to make more. That's how we learn.
Probably.
But I love the way that you guys did this, and I'm so happy for you.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And we really learned so much from you. You know, we started driving in 04, and you came on the air in 07, right?
Right.
And so, I mean, until you came on and you know, we weren't sure whether or not we wanted to drive the truck long haul or not, long term or not.
Right.
But then when it became clear that, yeah, this did seem to make sense for us, I thought, we're never going to be able to afford a truck. How on earth can this happen? We're either going to have to buy a house or a truck. You know?
Right.
And so when you came up with the thing about, and when we bought our house, I'm really, really glad that by that time that we knew that there was another option so that we didn't just not buy a house and lease purchase a truck instead, you know? But so by the time that you came on the air and you started talking about, well, you know, you can just save up and go get a $20,000 truck, I thought, oh, my gosh, yeah, we can do that. We can do that. And so anyway, so we're just really, really grateful, and I'd like for you to watch in your email over the next week for a little note to support. I've got to find some way to give back because we've gotten so much out of what, you know, we've learned from you. And anybody that's going to the CMC that's interested in becoming an owner-operator, they'll just learn so much from that, and they should not at all worry about the money that they spend on going to the CMC as opposed to saving for the truck. It's part of saving for the truck. It really is. And
yeah, you know,
we won't be there this year, but as soon as you open up the waiting list for 2016, we'll be on it.
Well, thank you. And thanks for, you know, the feedback. I love hearing stories like this. Really, this is what gets me up in the morning. And I love the fact that you want to give back. I probably shouldn't say this on the air because I just saw the email this morning, but one of the CMC participants who's been there a couple years now had bought tickets for him and his fiance this year, and she can't make it, and he's donating the ticket. Now, I think we are have a huge list of people that, you know, we could, you know, really deserve that spot. And so I just love the fact that the tribe is not only succeeding and doing so well, but they immediately think about giving back. And that's really what's going to make this industry better.
And Kevin, I'm really glad that you mentioned the tribe, because there was something else that I wanted to tell you about. And that is that I was listening the other day when you were talking about, you know, the problems with Facebook. And, you know, Seth and I have always been very, very, very Facebook shy. I'm as adamant about civil liberties as you are about economic liberties. And I just have a lot of problems with the data aggregation that goes on.
Right.
And so we made up an alias and got a Facebook account and have never been on. But, you know, I almost wish that we had some way that we could communicate without going on Facebook. I'd certainly be willing to pay. You know, I don't know if it could be a part of when you get on profit gauges and a small fee for people that are just on fuel gauges because they're not on owner operators yet. But if we had something, you know, that we could place we could go and discuss and connect without having to go through that, it sure would be great. We belong to a list. It's like a Google list, and they've never had any problems. You know, you subscribe and all that.
Yeah.
But I wanted to throw that out there because I know we miss a lot, but
we've looked at it too. And you know, we've tried several things. We had our own forums on our own website for a long time. And I said two things: they'll always be free. I don't want to charge people for this. And there will be no moderation, no censoring. Come on, we're all adults. Say what you want to say. We'll all deal with it. And both of those things were mistakes.
Yep.
And I have to look at it and say, as much as I wish that's the way life worked, that we could make it free and we could make it open to anybody and we didn't have to moderate, that's the way I'd like it to be.
Right.
But that's not life. It doesn't work. Horrible failure. And I had to shut them down. And then I thought, you know what? Everybody's on Facebook. Let's go do it over there. And that was just a whole new set of problems. So I think what you're describing, it doesn't include as many people, which is what I'm starting to learn we have to do. We just can't include everybody in the industry. We have to be more exclusive. And that might mean we have a small fee so that you are accountable and you're paying to be there. And we have to come up with some good rules on moderation, but I'm hoping maybe if we're paying and we get the right people in there, we won't need to moderate as much. So that is still a possibility. Right now, I'm really enjoying the fact that I'm not online anywhere because I am getting so much work done and I need it to. So we'll see. Thanks so much for the call and stay in touch. I can't wait to hear your story as it unfolds. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. You know, speaking of the tribe, which is the way I really like to refer to the other than tribe, I don't know what word to use. Listeners, members, I hate followers. It sounds kind of cultish. I don't like that one. But this morning, I mentioned I was on the road again. And this morning, last night I spent the night in Barstow. And anybody running over here would be familiar. The Flying J, I was in the parking lot across the street, the gravel lot, kind of tucked over in the corner. And this morning, Diesel and I got up and did a long hike about 3 miles up into the hills. And the hike we took goes right past the backside of the truck stop. And it's actually a big berm. And then you can look down onto all the trucks. And normally when we walk, in this whole walk, Diesel's just, he's just full of energy. He's all over the place. But for whatever reason, every time we would walk by there, he would climb up on the berm and just sit there and stare at all the trucks. He was just fascinated. And I thought, maybe he knows. Maybe he knows that's our tribe. And I've never seen him act like that. It was just kind of funny. Let's head off to Alabama. Javin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted you to go over my oil analysis with me.
All right. Let's take a look at what we've got here. All right. So it looks like on this sample, oh, we're missing some numbers. What are the miles on the engine right now?
625,000.
And how many miles was on the oil that's in there when you took the sample?
11,000.
Okay, so this is a, so it was changed 11,000 miles ago, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. All right, so not
I was
a lot
about changing to a full synthetic because I'm running the 50-40 weight rotella, shell rotella. So I was thinking about upgrading to a T6.
All right. So here's one of the reasons why they're flagging a couple things in your oil. The report says that you've got rotella T6 full synthetic, and it's showing it as a 5W30. And it sounds to me like what
I don't know how come they keep putting that. I write it down 1540. You know,
interesting.
But every huh. Yep.
Well, okay. And it doesn't really hurt the analysis. It's just I have to read it a little differently. For example, the only thing you really got flagged on was the viscosity. And it's only because they think it's a 30 weight, so your viscosity should be in the 11 or 12 range. And it's in the 14 range, which is really perfect for your oil. So your viscosity should not be flagged at all. It should be a zero. I mean, you have exactly the viscosity we would expect on a 1540. Other than that, they flagged fuel dilution at 2.9. Not a big deal. The only thing that concerns me is that 11,000 isn't a lot of miles. So it makes it a little difficult to know if this fuel dilution would get worse or not, and how much worse. If it stays under 4 in say 20,000 miles, then I don't worry about it. So what you might want to do, did you change the oil after you took this sample?
Yes, I already have changed it.
What you might want to do is, and if you're going to go to a synthetic, that's set well, before I recommend that, what's your oil consumption like? Are you using much oil?
No.
Okay. Then here's what I would do. I would run this oil out to 20,000 miles before you do a sample.
Okay. And, see, I went back with the 1540. So just run it to 20,000 and then do another sample.
Yeah. And then call me and then we'll decide. I don't think there's anything wrong with the engine. I mean, everything else looks so good. There might be a little fuel dilution, but we haven't put enough miles on the oil to know for sure. And everything else is just fine. I mean, it's really good. And that's why I don't believe we have any fuel dilution. You have no wear metals to speak of. I mean, the numbers you have for wear metals, I've seen numbers higher than that in oil right out of the jug. So I would not hesitate to run 20,000, take the sample, call me. And then we'll decide, you know, what your interval should be and whether or not it's a good time to go to synthetic. And I think it probably will be.
Okay, because I know you said Polaris had did a state-of-the-art upgrade in equipment to detect fuel dilution.
Yeah, the fuel dilution, their test is so sensitive now that I almost wish they would reset their numbers. Because we used to start at zero. And now, really, 2 is about what 0 used to be. So before, I used to say, as long as we're under 2, it's not a big deal. Now it's kind of if we're under 4. And it's just because their test is so sensitive. And then the other thing we always do we always correlate that against viscosity to make sure, you know, it's correct, and it always is. And then we check wear metals to see if there's really fuel in there and if it's causing a problem. That's where we'll see it. We'll see it in the wear metals. So you're good. Run this oil till 20,000 and call me back. Let's head off to Ohio. Herschel, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I have a question and a statement. The question being about fuel tax.
Okay.
My carrier will not allow me to run my own IFTA, and we went around and around about that, and they just will not do it. So you have to use theirs. And
okay.
Historically, I've never noticed a problem, but I just finally got mileage statements. Believe it or not, they do theirs monthly, which we've debated that also, but they won't change that either. But on the ones that I just got yesterday, the West Virginia tax rate, state tax rate, my understanding has always been 0.346. And I went on ProMiles, and sure enough, that's what it says. But the last 3 months' worth that they give me, they're charging 0.357, which means they're charging me 1.1 cents per gallon more than they should. And you'll love the answer they give. Well, that depends on your fuel mileage. I said, no, it doesn't. That is a state tax rate. Fuel mileage doesn't affect that.
Okay, so let me explain what they're doing wrong. Actually, the only thing they really did wrong was they didn't know the correct answer to this. West Virginia is one of the states that has a fuel tax surcharge that gets charged at the end of the quarter or whenever you file your fuel tax report. And so that's what happened. And everybody pays it. There's no way around it. Even if you never buy fuel in West Virginia, as long as you drive in West Virginia, they are going to charge you the rate that's at the pump, which is the one you're looking at. Now, if you go to ProMiles, which is a great place to look, scroll down to the very bottom of that chart, and you'll see a little box down there, and there's going to be four states in there. There used to be four states with the fuel tax surcharge, and now there's only three, but they still have all four in the box. One of them just says zero now. So that's what's happening. Those states say, you know, we're going to charge this much at the pump, but we're also going to charge this much more at the end of the quarter. And it's called a fuel tax surcharge.
I'm guessing it's West Virginia, Kentucky, and Indiana.
Yep. And it used to be, I think, Ohio is the one that dropped off, but they still show it on the list as zero.
Okay. Well, now that makes sense.
Maybe it was Virginia. I think it was Virginia.
I think it was.
So that is what's happening. So they're not doing anything wrong. They just didn't know the right answer.
Okay. I can live with that.
Yeah. Now the thing about, are they using your real fuel mileage to calculate your fuel tax?
Well, that's kind of under debate also. When I look at it, they claim that it is unit mileage, not fleet average, because they do have designations where it says unit, it says fleet, which means our terminal, when I ask about it, and it says company, which is the whole company wide, and J.J. Keller is the one doing the processing.
Okay. If it's close for you, then you're good. I mean, the ones we worry about are the ones that either use a fleet average across the board, or if you get outside their acceptable range, they drop you down to a fleet average. That's when you really get killed. If they're a little bit off, that's just going to be a calculation error, and I wouldn't worry about it. And honestly, as long as the company's doing it right, I prefer to let them do it. I mean, I let FedEx do mine for years and only threatened them when I would go outside their range and then I'd get penalized. So if they're doing it right and it sounds like they are, I'd let them go. So it's one less cost and one less hassle for you. And I'm going to come back to you right after the break with the music's playing. That means I've got to get out of here for just a couple minutes and I'll come right back. Stick around. Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, real quick, we're heading into the fourth segment. That means at the end of this, I'm going to say I'm done. I've got to get out of here, all that stuff. Just hang out because we'll come right back and do another hour. We have lots and lots of calls and questions right now, so I'll get to as many as I can. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment, so I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. I'm going to go back to Ohio. Herschel, so it sounds like you're good on the fuel tax, and I think you said you had a statement.
Yeah, and I don't want anybody to take this the wrong way, but I think we're all adults. I've never seen your signature truck other than at the factory when it was built, sitting in front of the plant for several weeks. So I live right here in Chillicothe, Ohio.
Okay.
And, you know, I really feel bad for the owners of the truck. I don't know them from a local. But I also kind of feel bad for Bruce over at Pittsburgh, because Bruce and the boys built my engine, and they have just done an awesome job with it. I'm up a mile to a mile and a quarter a gallon, depending winter or summer, and just been there top-notch. Anytime there's an issue, no problems. And I kind of feel bad. Bruce, I kind of got him in the regard of somewhat of a friend now. We've been dealing with each other for a couple, 3 years, and I kind of don't want to see him get a black eye over this thing, because I don't know why he didn't get the truck back when it went bad, but I kind of wish that he would have. And I guess that's about it. I just don't want to see Bruce get hurt over this deal, because I got a feeling I know he did it right. He's a stand-up guy. I just can't believe that they did anything wrong.
Well, and you know, I'm glad you brought it up, because you know, this is something that we're working on. It's something that I still spend a lot of time on. And you're right, Bruce has got thousands, tens of thousands of success stories. He's been doing this, got a very, very loyal following, and a lot of people, you know, like you. He's a friend now. I mean, and that's just the way Bruce is. That's the way Bruce likes to do business. Really, everybody involved with this project, it's all the companies we've trusted for years. There wasn't anybody really new. There are a couple shops, you know, somebody who built the transmission was a shop I didn't know. So I had to trust my partners sometimes that the vendors they were using were good. You know, and Bruce knows, being a part of this show makes him very, very visible, which is a good thing. It's good for all of us, but it can be bad for all of us too. Because when you're that sure. visible and you're out doing big things, and we think we're doing some pretty big things, you've got a big target on your forehead and another one on your ass. I mean, everybody's out, not everybody, but there are just people that are out to get you if you're doing stuff like that. They're out to prove you're wrong or you're going to screw up. And you know what? Sometimes we are wrong and sometimes we do screw up. One of the things that I learned from this project was that it was probably too big for me to take on at the time. It was just, there was a lot of other things going on and I pushed a little too hard to get it. There were a lot of signs. I mean, we tried building with different builders. We tried working with different OEMs to get the parts the way we wanted. And there was a roadblock everywhere. Sometimes roadblocks are there for a reason. Other times, you know, my thought is if they put up a roadblock, I'll find a way over it, under it, around it. And I kept doing that. And maybe that was a sign I was just pushing a little too hard on this project. It was a lot to manage. It got changed multiple times because either the OEM couldn't do something we wanted or one of the suppliers couldn't come through. And, you know, I'm confident we're going to get that thing running right for them. I do feel bad for Jeff and Kathy. They are the ones really dealing with this every day. And, you know, as far as my reputation and Bruce's and the other vendors, we'll be all right. I mean, we've all had enough successes, I think, that most people know. For the most part, we're all trying to do the right thing. And on this one, enough things went wrong that it really looks like a disaster. But we'll get through it. And I appreciate the support, you know, for Bruce as well.
Okay, Kevin. Have a good one. I'll let you be.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to North Dakota. Mariano, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How you doing?
Doing good. What can I help you with today?
I got a question for you. First of all, I'd like to tell you that you have a big, big, you're probably not aware of this, but you have a big, big audience in Mexico, too.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yes, sir. There's a lot of people that hear you. There's a lot of people that speak the language, and you got a lot of fans in Mexico, too.
Wow. Well, thank you. I think in all the time that I've been on the air, I've only had one call that came from Mexico. I didn't know if anybody down there or not.
Wow. Hello? Excuse me. Hold on. Hello?
Yep. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I have a 378 Peterbilt that's got a C15 cat on it. Got the 10-speed with 390s in the back. It's a 6MZ engine, and I just rebuilt it, and it's got its first 10,000 miles on it.
Okay.
And my fuel mileage just went down the drain. When I rebuilt the engine, I also put a new APU on it, okay. And I'm still getting the same kind of fuel mileage I got before I rebuilt the engine.
Okay, so there could be several things going on here. The good news is that, you know, if we don't figure it out today over the next 40 or 50,000 miles, if you call me back once in a while, we'll figure this out. I don't think this is going to be difficult. So let's talk about before we rebuild an engine, fuel mileage drops off slowly over time. As that engine wears out, we get more blow-by, we have less power going to the and we lose fuel. So typically when we rebuild an engine, we should see an increase. And I know that's what you're looking for. But there's also that initial tightness of all those parts, which that's what we call that break-in period. Now, you're not trying to break in a whole truck. You're just trying to break in the engine. And it should only take about 25,000 miles for that thing to loosen up. So you should see a slight increase over time. Now, what kind of shop is in frame on this?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Yeah, what kind of shop? Was it a truck dealer, an independent shop, a cat shop? Who was it? And you don't have to give me a name. I want to just tell me.
Right. It's just an independent shop, but the guy that worked on the truck can actually eat a cat. He's been around cat engines forever. Since he was a kid, I knew his dad, and they're just like cat specialists.
Good. I love that because they should be able to work with as we try to figure out what this is. Do you know if they made any changes in the ECM during this time?
No, sir. The ECM was not touched at all.
Okay. And you were happy with your ECM settings before and your fuel economy was good?
No, I was not. As a matter of fact, that's another question I have for you, because being the fact that I've been hearing everything good about a 6MZ, okay, and you know, on the top of the head, it's got that sticker that says max horsepower is 435, and they're telling me I can buck that engine up to 600 horsepower.
Okay, and here's where we want to set it. That 6NZ does really well at 550.
550, okay.
So there's a couple things. I don't know if this shop has the ability to tweak the ECM or not. Now, they should be able to go in and bump up your horsepower, but whether or not they're able to go in and really tweak the settings for fuel economy, which sometimes actually borderlines on, you know, is that EPA compliant or not? Pittsburgh Power, for example, they can go in and change virtually every setting in that ECM. Now, they've also had to get that approved through the EPA. So they have their fuel mileage settings that will maximize fuel economy, and they've also had those approved through the EPA, so it's a legal setting. If this company can do it and you like them, then by all means, let them do it. If not, we'll work through some of the other issues And then I would recommend, obviously, Pittsburgh Power to get your ECM maximized. Now, you can even overnight it to them or send it to them, the ECM itself. They can do it and send it back to you. You don't have to get the whole truck there. So that's where I've seen fuel mileage increases as much as a mile per gallon by tweaking the ECM. Now, your other option on a 6NZ is leave the horsepower right where it is and put a Pittsburgh Power box on it. That's going to give you a range of, you know, there's seven or eight settings on that one. So you would go, if it's on zero, you'll be right there at 430 horsepower where you are. But if you go all the way up to the top, you're going to be at 600 plus horsepower. And then you can tune it in wherever you want it every day. That's really a nice option.
Now, my question is, if I bump it up to 550, 600, do I have to start messing around with the transmission and the gears and all that? Or should I just leave that alone?
Just leave that alone. That won't affect anything. That what you've got will be just fine. You know, boy, I'm out of time. There are some other things I wanted to... you know what? We're going to get you back on another show, because I want to work on this with you, because we'll get this one. We'll get you good fuel economy out of this. I just don't have enough time right now. Unfortunately, the clock says I've got to go. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you back here next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. All right, everybody, we're going to go ahead and get started on another hour here. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and we answer your questions about everything trucking. Trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, getting started in the business, getting started as an owner-operator. We even talk about lifestyle kind of issues, health and fitness, whatever it might be. Bring it to the table. I'll do my best to get you an answer. And many times if I can't, somebody listening will help us out. At the end of the last show, I was talking with Mariano, and we were working on some fuel mileage issues, and I ran out of time, so we're going to bring him back on. Mariano, are you with me?
I am.
Okay. So those are just a couple things right now to keep in mind, but let's get down to some specific numbers. Tell me a little bit about your operation. What kind of trailer are you pulling? What are your average weights? What part of the country do you spend most of your time in, and how fast are you driving?
Okay, I'm in North Dakota, and I'm in the oil field business right now. That's why I'm kind of fishy right now about my fuel mileage, because everything's going down, and I need to take care of my money. Okay. All right, I'm pulling a pneumatic trailer, and I also have a Tut Hill 10.5 blower in there that I use to blow the frac sand with.
Got it. Okay. So what's your average length? That really varies up there in the oil. So are you running out and back, pretty local kind of stuff?
Yes, max around 300 mile radius.
Okay, so you've got some real challenges. How much time are your tires spending not on pavement?
I want to say on a week, I put about 1,500 miles, and I want to say I only do about 80 miles off-road. The rest is just pavement.
Yeah, so that's not too bad. You are dealing with a lot of challenges to horsepower or to fuel mileage, though, a lot. Short haul, back and forth, heavy, cold temperatures. You know, there's a lot going on here. So is this, what's the model of the truck?
It's a 378 2002.
Okay. All right, so Yeah, we've got a lot of challenges. I would venture to say that fuel mileage is probably in the low to mid fives.
It is. That's averaging. I'm using your Let's Truck gauges, and okay. I've only used five fuel ups with your program there, and it's averaging me 5.4. My lowest been 5.5 miles a gallon, and my highest have been 5.98.
Okay, great numbers, by the way. Thank you for having those. And I was right on, which usually I can get really close. And it's good that your range is actually really small. That's a good sign. You're not all over the board. You're not showing one tank at 4.3 and one tank at 6.5. I mean, you're right there in the fives all the time. My goal right now would be in the next 4 months that we get you to 6.5.
That'll be awesome.
That is certainly doable. Now, there's two things we need to focus on for you. We can ignore aerodynamics right now. Not a big enough factor for you to even worry too much about. We want to focus on rolling resistance. We want to get it as low as possible. And we do actually want to focus on performance and horsepower. Those things are going to help your fuel economy as long as you don't abuse the horsepower. You know, if you go out racing all the other guys, it's not going to work. But if you drive it right, you'll find that the horsepower will make this truck more drivable, and it's going to give you better fuel economy. So what do you have on for tires right now?
I have, I'm actually outside my truck right now, and I'm going to tell you exactly what I have. I got Goodyear's G282's MSDs.
That is the, those are your steers, right?
No, those are my drives. Goodyear's G282's MSDs.
Oh, all right. So let me go look those up. I am not familiar with fire. And while I'm, nope, let me just stick with that. Did you say 282s?
Yes, G282.
I wonder why I'm not familiar with it. That must be a fairly new tire because I can't even find that one on my chart. There's a
I've had
two,
them for a year and a half.
Yeah, they haven't made it to the list yet. There's a 182, which has got horrible resistance. There's a 291. I just can't find a 282 anywhere. So we don't know what the rolling resistance is. That's a challenge. But honestly, Goodyear does not have a lot of good tires for rolling resistance. Most of their drive tires are 140 and above. Now, here's the thing. Let's assume you're at 140. If we can get you down to 110, we pick up 0.3 of a mile per gallon just by changing tires. I mean, that gets us a good start. Steer tires, I usually don't worry too much about. Most steer tires are low enough rolling resistance. So I'm going to see if I can find that tire somewhere because you and I, hopefully, if you call me back, we'll be talking, you know, over the next couple weeks or months. But my guess is when you can afford to, you need to look at some other tires. So I want you to think about that on the next call. I'll have some tires you should use. In the meantime, are you doing any oil analysis?
No, and that's another topic I want to touch base with you because everybody's been telling me to change to synthetic, but I'm old school, and I've just been using regular mineral oil. I'm using that Mobil 1040. Or 1540,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I can tell you that synthetic is just a better oil. It really is. And now that you've got a clean in frame on that thing, synthetic will be one of the recommendations I'm going to make. You don't have to do it. The reason I'm looking at oil analysis is we want to make sure, no matter how good the shop is, we want to make sure something didn't go wrong on the rebuild or something doesn't need to be tweaked. And the quickest way to figure that out is with oil analysis. I can look at soot and fuel and all kinds of other things. So what I'm going to recommend for now is that I'm going to put you back on hold. If Kim is listening, Kim can pick up and explain how to get an oil sample kit out to you. You can go to our website and order them right online now, or you can call us and we'll take a look at that. It could be that the overhead is really out. Sometimes that happens early on after an in-frame. We could get the overhead tweaked. It could be something else just didn't work the way we hoped it did. And the quickest way to figure that out is with oil analysis. So let's start there. On the next call, I'll have some other ideas for you. Let's go to Texas. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Doing pretty good. I've got a 6x4 configuration with a power divider right now.
Okay.
On my truck. And I was looking at going to a 6x2. I was thinking about it because I've got to probably replace my back axle housing. It's seeping a little bit. Rust is attacking it. I'm going to probably have to replace it anyways. So I was thinking about going with a trailer axle, you know, or like a tag axle configuration. But I was a little worried about with, you know, with traction with the... you know, having like a power divider set up, can you get a locking differential in that first axle or not?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, there are a couple ways you could set this up that would minimize the traction issue. And there are, you know, in some situations, a 6x2 with a locking differential, which is what you're asking about, and the ability to other axle off the ground is actually much less likely to get stuck than a 6x4. What happens, though, is if we have just a plain vanilla 6x2 with the forward axle that doesn't lock and a rear axle that doesn't lift, now you're more likely to get stuck. It doesn't mean you shouldn't run it that way. There's lots of trucks running around like that. And when you look at the savings, if you have to pay somebody to yank you out of someplace once in a while, it's really not that big of a deal. So what it comes down to is how much money do you want to spend to get this done? And you're right that if you're going to do it, this is a good time. Rather than pay for a new differential and all that labor, it's going to be much more cost effective right now to switch to the 6x2 if you're interested. So let me get to a break. And when I come back, I'll give you a couple different options on set up that 6x2. And it, like I say, it really comes down to how much money you want to spend. The more money you spend, the less likely you are to get stuck somewhere. But that doesn't mean we should go spend all that money. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to head right back to Texas. Chris, you still with me?
Yes, sir.
All right. So one of the things you could do is if you're thinking about buying another differential, say a locking, then you could put that axle in the back and put a liftable forward axle. That is probably... Now, not probably. That is the best setup. Now, it's significantly more expensive, though. So, in most cases, honestly, it's not worth it. But if you're one of those guys that just wants this done the best way possible, that would be a locking differential in the rear and a forward lift axle. But you could also go with a locking differential in the front and just a trailer axle in the back with some dump valves. That's another way to go. you could honestly, since you already have all the parts, you could just leave your front axle the way it is. We got to do a little work to it, take out the power divider, close it off, some of those things. Throw a trailer axle in. That this is your least expensive option, and then run it for a while and see how bad your traction is. I would still recommend putting dump valves on the back axle so we can get the weight off of it. But that's really the way I would do it if it were me right now. I would build it with the minimum number of parts and see how I like it. And, you know, if I'm not getting stuck, then no big deal, and you got away, you know, with a lot less cost.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about, because I'm like, if I got to buy another axle housing and all that, I mean, I was thinking, well, why not just put a trailer axle back there? I wouldn't have the issues with it, wouldn't have to replace that differential and all that eventually, because I'm going to, my front one, my power divider and the front differential ain't but a year old. It's brand new. I put a brand new one in there because I had issues with my last one. So it was brand new.
Yeah, I would do that then. I would just grab a trailer axle, throw it on the back, do what you've got to do with the power divider and that on the front, and run it. And you know, you're probably going to be totally satisfied with that, and you'll pick up the fuel economy. So I would give that a shot. You can always change something later if you need to. Let's head off to Mississippi. Adam, welcome to the program.
Good day, Kevin. A couple things. We'll start with the tax stuff. The company that we're going through you guys, I've got so much write-offs. We're going to be able to show it as a loss in the worst way because of buying the new truck. And the guy told us to go ahead and not use the premiums and the medical expenses and just switch it over to our personal.
Good. Good.
And my question is, all the money that we've put into it since we did do the LLC and everything, all the money that we did put in towards the taxes for paying, you know, my half of, you know, being the only employee, what will happen on my side of the personal end of it with the W-2?
Well, we don't know yet. I don't know what your withholding was, if you withheld at a low rate, at a high rate. Basically, what we can do at this point, though, is we know based on what the accountants have told you that the business is a wash. I mean, you're not going to owe any tax. There's not going to be any real profit. Now, what it would be like is like, now it's just like you were an employee anywhere and you're going to go file a personal tax return.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, and there might even be a loss that's going to be carried over from the business. And if it is, then that just minimizes the amount of personal tax you owe. But the money that was withheld from you, you'll never lose it ever. I mean, it goes to pay whatever taxes due, and then what is left over, you get as a refund.
Oh, okay. All right, cool. I appreciate that. I tried to get through. You told me about the last time I spoke with you. You told me about the Tony Robbins Master of the Money of the Game Money Master of the Money.
Yeah, Money Master the Game.
You can find that if anybody's listening who wants to check that out. You can find that on Frostwire and download the whole entire book for free. I got through about 5 hours of it, and I couldn't handle his voice anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah, man. He was about to drive me up a wall. So I'm going to finish it up this week when I'm on the road, in a couple, probably when your show's over. But yeah, I do understand now what you're talking about, and the information is very invaluable in that, and seems to be quite, worth listening to for sure. I got completely annoyed with listening to the guy's voice for 5 hours straight through. And
you know, and I have a long history with Tony Robbins. I started listening to his stuff back when he was in his 20s. He was doing this, and then I've been to literally maybe 100 hours worth of seminars with him. I did a program once that he used to have called Mastery University, where It was a whole bunch of seminars spread out over 2 years in different places. And one was about money and one was about health and one was about, you know, different topics. And one was, 13 days straight. That one was actually in Hawaii, which was a blast. We put the kids through a program and it was good stuff. And his voice for me is the exact opposite. You know, I love listening to him. Now, I will tell you that over the years, he has done so many seminars. I mean, the number of seminars he's done and the hours and the number of people is in the millions. And right. At one point, he did permanent damage to his voice. And he had to go through all kinds of treatments on his throat and his voice box. And then he had to go through voice coaching to learn how not to do that because he would get so passionate on stage. And so his voice has really changed over the years. And it is a little rough right now. But, you know, this is also a book that I would recommend you get the paperback or the hardback, because it's one of those books that you're going to want to go back and highlight things and say, okay, what exactly did he say I was supposed to do? And on an audio, that's really tough.
Right. Right. Yeah, we're looking to get in the book for sure. You know, we're starting to do this retirement stuff now, so I really want to get that going. The other thing is also, I want to give a shout out to the guys over at, you know, you recommended me to Action over in Orlando a while back, and we've been using them. Just to let you know, they got a new service writer, and the guy's really good at what he does. And I've been in there twice now. You know, check engine light, whatever might be going on, just simple stuff. You know, and I've been in there twice in the last month, and I haven't had a bill yet.
Yeah, that John is like that. John's the owner, John Doug, and John's a personal friend of mine, and just an all-around great guy. I mean, no question. That's a tough business to run, and he grew that from him and one little truck running around, and I started with him when he had one truck, and he was doing the work, and he'd come over to the yard and do the work for us, and now he's got multiple locations. They've got some great service contracts that they do. I used to go over there all the time and say, John, you got to charge me something,
I think I got one of your old, filters from OPS or something that you had left there when I didn't have one, when I pulled in one day.
It could be. I had all kinds of, stuff from me, because I was always testing stuff, and we would literally run a unit for 3 or 4 months, pull it off, and I would tell them, hey, hold on to it, I'll use it someday. And I kind of left and sold my trucks and thought, hey, you know what, they did such a great job for me over the years, they can have all that stuff, they'll put it to good use. So thanks for the feedback on them. Great company, Action Mobile in Orlando, not far from the notorious truck stop down there on South Orange Blossom Trail. They're only about, a couple tenths of a mile around the corner. To Illinois. Robert, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind today? And you got about a minute or so, and then we'll get to a break, and I'll come back to you.
Okay, I got a question about the those bracelets that you were testing, the fitness bracelets. Did you pick your favorite?
I did.
You got some, can you tell me something about them? Or you have post on a Facebook maybe?
So I can compare. No, because I'm not on Facebook anymore. So I can give you a couple ideas. Here's the thing. Really, every band I tested, if it was the only band I would have owned, I would have been happy with all of them. They all did what I wanted them to do. They all kept track of my activity. They all had an app that worked on my phone. They all synced to some sort of a dashboard online. So, like I say, if I would have bought any one of them and it was the only one I had, I would have been happy. So when I come back, I'll kind of tell you where I am with the ones that I like the best. The good news is, from the ones I tested, the Jawbone, a couple different Fitbits, an iFit. They all worked great. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to get right back to the phones. I was talking with Robert before the break. So, Robert, what I ended up really liking the best was any of the Fitbits, mostly, I think, because that was the first one that I actually got online with and, you know, started adding a bunch of friends. So now I have some people that, you know, challenge me to different things each week. Like right now, we're doing a whole work week challenge to see who gets in the most steps in 5 days. And there's, I don't know, like 10 or 15 people in it. And, you know, on those days where I might not walk as much, I think about the challenge and it just keeps me a little more motivated. But I think all of the bands probably have something very similar to that. Now, I'm using the Fitbit Surge, which is their most expensive model. I think it was like $250, but it's got GPS. I can see all my readouts right on the band. It's more like a watch face kind of thing. You don't need that. I mean, if you want to spend that much money and you want the GPS tracking, you know, I used it this morning because we went out for a long hike up in the hills and I can come back and see on the map where I was walking and all that stuff. But you know, the standard Fitbit for $49 worked great. It's very accurate. I can see all that information on my phone. So it really depends on what you want to spend. Now, after testing all these, I know that I'm going to be using the Apple Watch just because it works so well with everything else I already have. You know, everything in our company is Mac, my laptops, my desktop, my phone, my iPad. I might as well have the watch. It'll work with everything. But again, that comes down to cost. I mean, because that's going to be probably $500 for that one.
I was thinking about something around $100. And also the thing that I would like to have is sleep monitoring. You know.
Let me tell you about the sleep monitoring. On every band I tested, it sucks. I'm glad you asked about that. They are horribly inaccurate when it comes to sleep. I mean, they're not even close for me. And I was testing it against a written diary that I would keep. So I'd write down when I would fall asleep. I would write down right before I fell asleep, obviously, when I went to bed. If I woke up enough to be aware that I was awake, like if I had to get up and go to the bathroom, or if I got up and I was thirsty, or if I got up and just laid there and I knew I was awake, I would just make a note that I woke up. And then I would write down the time that, you know, I woke up the final time and got out of bed. Plus, I had the bedside monitor. So I was doing this pretty extensively. The bedside monitor was really accurate compared to what I was writing down. It would tell me that I woke up a lot more times than I knew of. Like I might only write down one or two times that I could remember actually waking up. And it might say I was up 11 times. The band, I mean, I would be asleep for six and a half hours, and it would tell me I only slept for three. I mean, it wasn't even close, and that was all of them. I mean, that was the Fitbit, the iFit, everyone that had sleep tracking. In my opinion, they're just not worth it.
How much is that bedside device?
I think it was almost $200.
Okay.
I think it's like $190-some. It's made by ResMed. And you know what? I learned a lot from it. I really did. I don't use it every night anymore because I've gotten to the point now where I really understand what's going on in my sleep. The other interesting thing is when I first started using the ResMed, my sleep score, and that's how it gives you a score every day. My sleep score was in the 60s on a good day. It was in the 50s on a bad day. And some of my worst nights were in the 40s. But when I had a 40, my God, I was worthless the next day. I mean, I just felt horrible the next day. So I know I had a bad night's sleep. Now that I've made all these changes in my lifestyle over the last couple months, the way I'm eating, I gave up alcohol. I didn't drink a lot before, but I drank a glass or two of wine every night. I gave that up for now. We'll see what happens. I'm eating very differently and I'm much more active. What's happened now, my sleep scores most nights are in the 40s. They are absolutely horrible because I'm only sleeping some nights four and a half hours. And I wake up and I feel great. I've got tons of energy. And I can do that 4 or 5 nights in a row. And then I'll start to feel it a little bit. And I'll just make it a point to get 6 or 6.5 hours. I never get 7 or 8 anymore, but I don't need it. I feel so much better. So now the ResMed just isn't really giving me much good information. It's telling me I have these horrible sleep scores, but I actually feel better than I ever have.
Okay. Another question that I have is about an application that you said that you're using. That's about monitoring my personal expenses and money that's going out of my account. I'm making too much money, you know, to not know where it's going.
Right.
So you said that you are using some application. What was the name of that application? Do you remember?
Yeah, for on the business side on trucking, it's not an app on the phone. It's an app online on the computer, and that's ours. That's Profit Gauges. That's what we're using to track all of our business and truck expenses. Personal, I'm using Mint.com, and it's free. It's by Intuit. There's an online version, and then there's a phone app. And you connect all your different accounts to it, checking accounts, credit cards, savings accounts, investment accounts, your houses, your cars, whatever you want. And not only does it keep track of all your expenses and categorize them for you just from being online, you don't have to do much of the work. It will also help you calculate your net worth and watch it every day if you want. I look at mine every day. Let's see. Let's get to some phone calls. Let's go to Nebraska. Andy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I hope you're having a great day. I've got a question about the EcoPure.
Okay.
It's got different filter sizes. I've got a 2010 P387 with the ISX 450. I'm curious, what's the difference between like the 8 and 10 inch filters and is it just the length of time before you take samples or what?
Yeah, that really is the two differences why we look at a different size filter. One is space. And in most Class 8 trucks, space just isn't an issue. 10 inch filters fit just fine. When we look at some of the hot shots and some of the other smaller vehicles, we go with the smaller filters just because of space. The bigger filter just lets you go longer. So virtually everybody with a Class 8 truck, I recommend the 10-inch filters, and that way you can go 25,000 miles between samples.
Okay. The other question is, you change that filter every 25,000. Do you also change your main filters at the same time?
No, I do the main filters every other time. So I've set up kind of like an A and B service. A, you know, the EcoPure gets changed, and I have some other things I do on the truck. On the B, the EcoPure and all the full flow filters get changed, and I have a couple other things that go along with it. But I do the full flow filters every other time. I used to do the full flow filters there was a time where I only did them every year, and actually it worked. And then I don't even know why. I think somebody at OPS convinced me I probably shouldn't let them go that long. So I went to 6 months, and then 6 months turned out to be, you know, on my trucks pretty close to that every other time anyway. So it turned out to be easier just to do the AB service and do them every other time.
All right. That sounds good. Now, when I put this system on, I want to change to synthetic. I've got 514,000 miles on the truck, and it hardly uses any oil at all.
Good.
I think I put maybe a gallon in about 20, 25,000 miles. So I think the engine's pretty tight. It's also got a weird configuration on the rear axles. Actually, it's got no power divider, so all four wheels are running it all the time. So if I switch that, I don't know if I can put a power divider in there, or would it be better just to switch it to a one axle drive? And what do you think I'd pick up in fuel mileage by doing that?
I'm a little confused about what kind of rear end setup you have now. Who makes it?
I do not know. It was set up by US Express. It had wide singles on it, and it has no power divider, but it's got both drive axles, and it seems to run all the time. There's I had Peter don't look at it, and they said it was a weird setup they've not seen, and I thought it was kind of weird to have all four running at the same time. I'm getting 6.8 miles a gallon since I got the truck.
Hold that thought, because I'm trying to think of a couple things here, how that's working. Interesting. Stick around. I'll come right back, and we'll talk about that. Check out the website. It's letstruck.com. We'll be right back. Don't go away. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to go right back to Andy. Andy, I was just trying to figure out in my head. So you've got a forward differential, and
right.
Is there a drive shaft coming out of that differential somehow? There must be.
You got your regular drive shaft. It goes back to the first axle, and then you got a drive shaft from the from that axle back to the rear axle. And it just seems to run in four-wheel drive all the time.
And it's not an integrated power divider?
I'm not sure how integrated. I mean, it might be built into it, but there's no way for me to turn it off. There's no switch in the truck to turn off the power divider, so it runs both axles all the time.
Well, all right, so... Actually, that's a little backwards, but let's explain, because a lot of people get this wrong, and this is, I haven't talked about it in a while. So in the mode that we normally drive a 6x4 down the road, the power divider is sending power to the two different differentials based on traction, but it's the opposite of what most people think. It sends more power to the wheels with the least amount of traction, not the most. So it's the opposite. So it is not a 50-50 split like a lot of people think, unless we're going straight down a level road and the traction is exactly equal between the two axles. If that's the case, then you'll get a 50-50 split. But that almost never happens in the real world. It's constantly changing. And that's what helps with tire wear and all kinds of issues. Now, each differential is doing the same thing between each wheel end. It is sending more power to the wheel with the least amount of traction, which is why a truck is able to go around a corner without, one of the wheels hopping, because when you go around a corner, one set of wheels has to travel a much shorter distance than the outside. So that's what a differential does, and a power divider is really just a differential between the two axles. Now, when we have a switch on the dash and we lock in the power divider, Now what we're saying is no matter what happens with traction, we are going to send the same amount of power to both axles. Now, each differential is still doing its job unless we were to have locking differentials. Now, if you had a power divider locked in and you locked in both differentials, you would be amazed how hard it would be to turn the truck. They jump all over the place. I mean, it's ridiculous. But that's a really odd combination. You'd only do that in like extreme off-road kind of stuff. And then that would lock in all four wheel ends to all get power all the time. But when we have two differentials and a power divider, we don't have anything locked in. The power is being spread out among all of those wheel ends at all the time at different rates. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. So it actually works. I just don't have a way of locking it.
Locking it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
So it's not really making that much difference in my fuel economy then.
None whatsoever.
Why not having that switch?
Nope.
Okay. You know, I kind of jumped into that real quick. On the OPS, I wanted to put the synthetic in. Do I need to take a sample of the oil that's in here now, or do I wait until I put 20,000 on the new oil?
Yeah, wait until you put 20,000 on, because we like to do that first sample as a baseline, but there's no point doing a baseline on oil you're changing. So I would skip it this time, put the synthetic in, and then do your first sample if you wanted to at 20,000, or you could wait till 25. Let's go to North Dakota. John, welcome to the program.
Hello. Is there any difference? Like, is there a 355 heavy duty rear end and a 355 light duty rear end?
Well, yes, there are different rear ends, and there are several ways they could be different. When we talk about either light duty, standard duty, heavy duty, we could be talking about the housing itself, not the gears or anything, just the actual housing, how thick the metal is. And that becomes an issue when we talk about wide singles. If you have the light duty housing, they tend to flex a lot more because the metal is thinner. And that's where we get the bearing overheating and the inside tire wear. Whereas the heavier housing won't flex as much. We also have different widths. So if you get a light duty that's really wider, then you're going to get even more flexing. If you get a heavy duty that's shorter, your wheels are going to be inset a little bit more, but then all that wear issue goes away. That's one way they can be different. The other way is that the standard gear set in most 6x4 trucks is what's referred to as a 20,000-pound axle. So you put two of them together, now we can put 40,000 pounds on that combination. There are also 23,000-pound axles. Those are typically and that's a bigger housing and a bigger, heavier-duty gear set. And that is typically what you'll see on a true single-axle truck, a 4x2. For example, all of FedEx's, the trucks they pull double with, all the UPS, almost all the big line haul companies that build single axles to pull doubles and triples, those are 23,000-pound axles.
The reason I was asking is a buddy of mine is driving a truck, and his mechanic says, be easy on it because he's pushing 550, 600 horse on the motor, and they're saying that if he romps on it too much, he'll tear out the rear end, which I'm understanding as being the gear set. So I'm wondering if the gear sets are heavy duty and light duty.
Yes, that's what I just talked about, the 20,000 or the 23,000. But here's the thing. If you abuse a truck, you're going to do more damage to it. But virtually every 6x4 truck on the road, which is just about every semi built, I mean, that is the most common configuration. Every fleet, everybody has that. We've had them for years. They're all 20,000-pound axles. Now, we've been building high horsepower, high torque engines for years and years. It isn't just that, if you have 600 horsepower or 1,800 foot-pounds of torque, you're going to tear up the rear end. that's not necessarily true. I mean, look at what we've got, students driving these things all the time. The standard duty axles will take a lot of punishment and they'll take a lot of horsepower and torque. Granted, the easier we drive them, the longer they're going to last. But I've seen differentials last well past a million miles that aren't taken care of very well, that the drivers aren't very good, and they still go a million plus. I know people who get 2 million miles out of their differentials if they're really taken care of and driven the right way. So, it's not bad to caution somebody, but I wouldn't worry too much about it. I mean, we should be driving easy anyway for lots of reasons. Fuel mileage, tire, clutch, everything.
So the same type of issue between the 279 and the 390, they're still going to handle the same amount of horsepower torque?
Yep. Okay. The gear ratio doesn't tell us anything about how heavy duty a gear set is. That those are two different issues. One of the things that can come up, though, as you get to a higher gear ratio, which is a lower number, like 290s, 270s, those kind of things, what you're doing then is you will put more stress on the clutch and the U-joints and differentials because it's a higher gear, so it's harder to get the truck moving. And that's why you hear me sometimes question people about startability. Yeah, but that doesn't mean the gears are weak or light. It just means that because of that gear ratio, you're going to have to feather the clutch a little bit more, which puts a little more stress on the clutch and the U-joints and that kind of stuff. But again, those will hold up really well to a reasonably good driver.
Okay. That answers my question. Thank you very much for your time, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head up to South Carolina. Ricky, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Kevin?
Good. What can I help you with today?
I just had an end frame done on my truck. I got a 2003 Volvo with the ISX. I had an end frame done on it last month, and I've done ran the truck for about 17 days. So after the first 5,000 miles, I take my oil, and I had to add a gallon of oil.
Okay.
So the next 2 weeks, I ran another 5,000 miles, and I had to add a gallon and a half of oil.
Okay, don't get too worried yet. I would keep track of this, though, in writing. It's possible the rings aren't going to seat, and this will continue to happen. But I've also seen a lot of engines that do this for maybe the first 15 or 20,000 miles, and then they'll straighten out. That happens quite often. So I wouldn't worry too much about it yet, but I would certainly check the oil every day, if not sometimes twice a day. And I would keep track of this on paper. And if it doesn't settle in by 20,000, it probably never will, and it's going to have to be rebuilt again. I'm all out of time. Thanks for joining me. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
Thanks for tuning in to The Audio Road. If you have any questions, give us a call at 855-800-FUEL. That's 855-800-3835. Check out the website at letstruck.com and find us on facebook.com/letstruck.